are reading with us. If you aren't reading, I still hope that there'll be something in the Sunday evening studies of Bible books that will be helpful. Genesis will be a little easier than Leviticus to summarize in a sermon, to be sure. There'll be other instances that may be even harder than Leviticus, like in Ezekiel. But still, if we really want to get something from the text together, I think there'll be a good bit there for us. We divide our Old Testaments into four major divisions, usually. Law, history, poetry, and prophecy. Sometimes we subdivide prophets into major and minor prophets. And you know sort of how those fall. If you just look at law, you're looking at the first five books of the Old Testament, which we call Pentateuch. If you're looking at history, you're generally thinking of the books from Joshua up to the book of Job. If you are looking at major prophets, you're thinking in terms of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And if you're thinking of minor prophets, the remaining 12 of the Old Testament. In Luke 24, verse 44, Jesus indicates that the Jews in his time used a different division. He was talking with his disciples after his resurrection, and he said, "This I said unto you while I was yet with you, that all things that are written of me in the law of Moses and in the Psalms and in the prophets must be fulfilled." There's a threefold division instead of a fourfold division, which is an interesting thing. Law would still be the first five books of the Old Testament. But Psalms now would include all the poetic writings, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, the writings they're usually called. And prophets would include both prophets and books of history. Perhaps that has a greater bearing when we get to the books of history for our study. But the Jews called the historical books, as we call them, the former prophets, and the others, the latter prophets. Which is to say that the history books of the Old Testament are not just reciting history. They're there for a prophetic purpose. They have a message to teach, a spiritual or religious truth, and not just chronicling events. So, law, prophets, and Psalms summarizes what is there. The Old Testament is unique in ancient literature, and there's no place to see that more quickly than in those books of history or those former prophets. You have from Joshua through 2 Kings a 12-book sequence of history without any parallel in the ancient world. That sequence covers from Joshua to the time King Jehoiakim was released from prison, a period of time longer than the entire remainder of the Bible following 2 Kings covers, several hundred years. Jehoiakim was released from prison in 561 B.C., That's the end of that 12-volume history that I'm talking about. Herodotus, the Greek writer, is usually called the father of history. After Herodotus had written two or three legendary pages to get his history going, and you can find it in any large university library today, he begins his history with the accession of Croesus to the throne in 560 B.C., That is to say that the man normally called the father of history begins his record of history with events that happened the year following the close of 2 Kings, which ends a 12-volume history in the Old Testament. So we've quite an unusual collection of writings here. But tonight we're going to look at the first of those five books known as Law. The Jews carried these five books together in one huge scroll. And their name for the first section of that scroll was Bereshith. That's the first word in the Hebrew Bible. It means in beginning. It comes to us in the word Genesis, which is a Greek word that is passed through Latin into the English language and means origin or beginnings. But the first five books in a Hebrew Bible were kept in one long, unbroken scroll, 40, 50 feet long. Better synagogues, I don't mean better in a moral sense, but I mean the more expensive ones, better synagogues in our time still have that huge scroll with the five books of law written on one volume in a depository they call the Ark, which lies at the rear of the pulpit area of the synagogue. It was when the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew into Greek, which process was begun at least in the 3rd century B.C. after the spread of the Greek language through the conquest of Alexander the Great around 333 B.C. When the Old Testament was translated into Greek, these five parts of the Pentateuch were broken down into five books, and they were given names in Greek, which again have passed into our language. Genesis, I've mentioned, means beginning. Exodus comes from a Greek term meaning emigration, because it describes the exodus of Israel from Egypt to the land of Canaan. Leviticus simply means the book of the Levites. Numbers comes from a Greek word, arithmoi, where we get arithmetic, because there are two numberings of the people of Israel there. And Deuteronomy, Deuteros 2, or second Namas law, or the second giving of the law. The old generation that left Egypt on its way to Canaan died out in the wilderness of wandering. And consequently, before Moses died, he gave the second giving of the law to the younger generation which had grown up in the wilderness. Hence, Deuteronomy. So it's the first of those books, the beginning, the book of beginnings, that we want to focus in on tonight. Now, the text gave us, I think, the real theme of the book of beginnings. And that is that in the beginning, when God decided to create the heavens and the earth, after he'd made the material creation, he decided to make man in his own likeness. I don't mean the decision was made then. I mean the creation occurred then. He made man in his own likeness, in his image. If man had not been made so lofty, he couldn't have fallen so low. If he hadn't been made to love, he couldn't have lusted. If he hadn't been made for companionship with other people, he wouldn't have been capable of such hatred and strife with other people. But it's the very fact that God made him in his image that necessitated God doing something else, because his whole purpose would have been lost if he had not spoken another word beside creation, namely the word redemption. So the book of Genesis sets out to tell us how things came to be and how the need for redemption developed and what God's earliest steps in his plan for redemption actually were. Now, how do you start reading a book like that? Well, in the first place, we have to try some way to get into the spirit of the writer of the book. It doesn't make any difference what book of the Bible we're reading. We want to know as much about the writer and the people he's writing to as we possibly can. We want to capture the mood of the book. Someone having read Paradise Lost asked, but what does it prove? Well, it doesn't prove anything. It wasn't written to prove anything. But that's the wrong question to ask about Paradise Lost. That question is all right about Euclid's geometry, but it just doesn't have a bearing there. Consequently, when we pick up the book of Genesis and say, well, where did Cain get his wife? There really isn't a direct answer there. Now, I have a judgment, and you may have a judgment. I think she was one of Adam's daughters. I don't know any other place she could have come from. But the book of Genesis didn't really set out to answer all of the questions my curiosity might have the ability to raise. It set out with a purpose, and it would be to my greatest advantage if I want to profit from the book to find out what is that viewpoint of Moses, the writer. What is he trying to get across? What are his purposes? I don't believe, for example, that Moses meant to tell me the scientific processes by which God brought the world into being out of nothing. I wouldn't have understood them if he'd told me. But I do believe Moses meant to tell me the source of everything that is. God, the purpose for which everything was created, God's purposes, and Moses outlines them. The peculiar, unique nature of man and his ability to have relationship with God, the intrusion of sin into the world and the consequences that intrusion entailed, and the necessity for God to plan redemption for man, otherwise the whole creation would be a failure. That's the viewpoint of the writer. We have to get some kind of historical perspective if we're going to read Genesis appreciatively. God didn't reveal things to man, ordinarily at least. You may think of an exception. But God did not ordinarily reveal things to man that man could discover for himself. So he did not primarily write a book of science. We now have our telescopes and microscopes and other instruments through which to make scientific discovery. This is not to say that the Bible is scientifically inaccurate. I don't believe that. I believe it's scientifically accurate, where it has a bearing on matters of science. But it is to say that it is not the primary purpose of the Bible to deal with scientific concerns. The same may be said with history. History is there, but it's selected history. It's history with a special purpose. I would be very upset if I learned that reliable secular history and biblical history were in contradiction with each other. I would want very much to know the dependability of the one as I measured against the other. But that, fortunately, is not the case, as archaeologists have shown us ever since the days of Napoleon particularly. But the historical perspective we need to get hold of is that Moses is living around 1500 B.C. He's not trying to tell me the scientific discoveries of an Einstein's theory of relativity. He isn't trying to unfold for me the entire history of the planet. He has a purpose. He has a perspective. We don't even expect to find in the book of Genesis the same moral standards being lived by that we would find in the Sermon on the Mount. That doesn't mean that Genesis is immoral or amoral, not moral at all, that is. It is to say that God's going to develop men a long time before he sends his son into the world to give the final climactic revelation of what spiritual and moral living must be like. So if we can get back into the viewpoint of the writer, why did he write? What is he trying to tell us? Then we're going to have a better chance of understanding what he says. I think it will also help if we can understand a little bit more than we do of the thinking of the Hebrew mind. There's quite a difference between the Greek mind and the Hebrew mind, and we have more in common with the Greek mind than we do with the Hebrew mind because we're Westerners and they're Easterners. But the Hebrew tended to think in terms of pictures and symbols and striking presentation, while the Greek tended to think in analytic and philosophic terms. Again, this is not to say that the Hebrew is irrational. He's open to reason. He is rational. But I mean that when a Greek philosopher gets hold of reality and starts talking about it, he wants to have a system that will give perfect balance and will explain the problem with which it deals, sort of like a mobile in a child's room, you know, just perfectly balanced. If it's all there, you don't ever worry with it anymore. You just let it stand there and wave in the breeze and admire it because it's beautiful. That's not what you get in the Bible. In the Bible, you get involvement. You get truth not only through reason, but through history, because God acts in history. When you read Moses, he'll say to that second generation in Deuteronomy 4 and verse 5, you saw and you heard. You were there at Sinai. You were young, but you saw it. You heard it. You know what happened. Same thing you get from Joshua later when he calls on the people to choose between the gods of the Amorites in whose land they dwell and Jehovah God. Now you've seen the evidence. Weigh it and decide. Same thing you get from John, the close of his book, when he says, many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe. Something has been done in history. Now, what have we said? That we ought to read the book of Genesis primarily for the purpose for which it was written. That we ought to try to get historic perspective of the way Moses himself is looking at things from his own time with the help of the Spirit of God, of course. And that we ought to realize that the Hebrew mind is not interested in standing off and describing some metaphysical scheme, nor did the Holy Spirit do that through them. But what is described here is God's will and man's action in obedience to it. Now, with that as introductory material, how do you go into the book? Well, the best way is just to begin reading it. Of all the ways available, that's the best way. It will always be the best way. First-hand, halting steps toward knowledge of the Scripture will always be better than second- or third-hand, polished steps. There's the simple fact that you and I cannot make one another's consciousness equal to our own. That it would be better to have our own impoverished understanding than what we consider to be somebody else's wealthy understanding. That the best thing for us to do is get a first-hand introduction to the Scriptures themselves. We've got to go inside the book. How do we do that?
Well, I'd like to make some simple suggestions. One is, as you read Genesis, how much time is being covered here? Are there some parts where long periods of time are covered in very short spaces? And some parts where short periods of time are covered in very long spaces? If so, that will tell you something about what the writer considers important, what the Holy Spirit is trying to get across. For example, in Genesis 1 through 11, you have all the centuries from the creation down to the call of Abraham, generally dated around 2000 B.C. Sometimes later, it depends on the archaeologist as to how late he will date it. But you have centuries and centuries there, covered in 11 chapters. The next 39 chapters, chapters 12 through 50, cover the lives of four generations of one family: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. If 39 chapters are devoted to four generations, and 11 chapters to all those other centuries, it would seem obvious that what Moses is doing in the first 11 chapters is giving us an introduction to the whole. And what he's doing in the last is zeroing in on what God's purpose for redemption is now among men. Look at the time span. Or look at the characters. Who are the characters in this book? Is more space given to some characters than to other characters? Why? Why are these characters more important than those characters? The first 11 chapters deal with the whole human race. The last 39 chapters deal with four generations, as I said, of one man's family: Abraham and his descendants. Why did God choose them? What is his purpose for them? Why does the writer center in on this one family instead of all the races of earth? That tells you something about what's being done in Genesis and what the purpose of the book is. Or look at geography. The first 11 chapters of Genesis cover the scattering of men into the whole world. Last 39 chapters deal with one nation of people, and though they're not always in Canaan, their hearts are always there. They're carried down into Egypt for a while, but when the book closes, they're still in Egypt, but they know that their real destiny is back up in that little land, 50 miles wide, 150 miles long, right in the middle of what's called the Fertile Crescent. Abraham, you see, came out of the Ur of the Chaldees, and with a map you can see over by the Persian Gulf, the section, the Ur of the Chaldees. And then there was a crescent-shaped fertile area around the huge Arabian desert that reached all the way down to Egypt at the other end. Abraham left the area of that huge eastern kingdom and traveled eventually all the way to that huge western kingdom of Egypt, but he settled down in between. If God wanted to affect all nations of men through one family, through one nation that came out of one family, what better place could they dwell in the ancient world than in the midst of that fertile crescent where the trade traveled from one place to another? Well, it brought lots of problems. The kings would get into it with each other, and they always fought across Israel, and Israel got trampled underneath. But it also brought lots of opportunities. Israel just didn't always use them. But look at time, and look at characters, and look at geography. Look at genealogies. There are lots of them in Genesis. And you just wonder, why does he give such a long genealogy there and just let it drop into oblivion? You don't know anything about those people past that. But he always picks out one group and keeps going through them. Why? Well, the best way to get hold of that, I think, is to try to image the whole book. What's being said in the whole book? Then you're ready for the parts. Now, maybe not all of us will take time to do this, but with a general perspective, we read with a little bit more meaning. The purpose of the first 11 chapters, the purpose of the last 39, what would those purposes be? In the first 11 chapters, there are certain basic questions that human beings ask that are answered, that are dealt with. One of them is, why did God create the universe anyway? And the best answer you can come up with from Genesis is, for man. Man's the crowning part of the universe. He's the one who is there to enjoy it. Maybe you want to go back of that and say it's so man could be in companionship with God. But he creates it for man. That raises a second question. Why does he create man? What's man's purpose? When you read Genesis 2 carefully, you begin to see man was set in the garden to enjoy it. But he also had labor. He was to dress and keep it. He also had obedience to God. Don't you eat of that tree. You may eat of all the rest.
And finally, God put him in society. He made a help suitable for his needs and put her alongside him, making the family unit. That's why man is there. Man is there to enjoy it, to labor in it, to develop in moral and spiritual qualities as he obeys his Lord, and he does that best in human relationships. That's why man is created. Then where did all this sin and tragedy and suffering come from? That's Genesis 3. Came because man decided to vaunt himself up, to set himself in proud rebellion against God, to exalt himself instead of being obedient to God. Well, the rest of the first 11 chapters tell us the story. That rebellion is climaxed in the life of a man named Lamech, whose own sinful desires are set out in chapter 4, verses 23 and 24. And the rest of the early section tells us the simple story of how God destroyed, made a new beginning. Twice he did that. Once with a flood, once in a different way at the Tower of Babel. The destruction there was not wiping out life, but scattering people so they couldn't collaborate in their evil doing. But this is the trigger for it all. Sin had begun, and Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, hearken to what I say. I've slain a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. Sin is really underway. God brings a flood. New beginning. Sin again. Babel. New beginning. But now, he passes from that work with the whole human race, because new beginnings won't do it. Man falls right back into sin, into a new plan. I don't mean by that God never had the idea before, but I do mean that this is the way he's unfolding it. He gives man various opportunities. Now he comes with a promise to Abraham in Genesis 12, which he repeats several times in the book, eventually to Isaac and to Jacob, son and grandson of Abraham. In that last 39 chapters, we have to just get hold of one character at a time. There are four basic ones there. The others come in, but they're all subsidiary to the four, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. As you look at Abraham, here's an event in Genesis 15 where he offers a sacrifice to God and God reaffirms his promise. It takes about 24 hours of Abraham's life in that one chapter. You have to ask, how did God prepare him for that? Where does he go from there? What happens in Abraham's life to give him such a problem? The passing of time, no son born for the promise to be fulfilled through. Oh, that Ishmael might live in thy sight. No, you're going to have a son. And finally, Isaac comes. But there's the development of Abraham, and finally that crucial test for great moral and spiritual development at Abraham when God called on him to sacrifice his son, Isaac. So looking at the characters individually, one begins to see what God is doing in shaping human beings. But now let's try to tie it together. Genesis has several major themes. One of them is creation. Jean-Paul Sartre, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, atheist in the world, living today on the left bank in Paris, says that the one basic philosophic question man has to face is, why is something there and not nothing? That's the rudimentary state that man has to begin working with, because something is there. Where did it come from? There are only some three or four possible answers. One is that once there was absolutely nothing, and then there was something. Nobody has ever really tried to defend that. Once absolutely nothing, no space, no time, no mass, no energy, nothing. A second is that everything has come from something that is impersonal. A third, everything has come from something that is personal. A fourth, there's always been a dualism, a good power and a bad power. The first has never been held seriously by anyone. The last, dualism, is not held seriously because man's always looking for some unity behind the dualism. We just have two answers left. Did everything come from something impersonal or something personal? The 20th century man generally has decided impersonal. Eastern thought has decided impersonal. The Bible says something personal. If you believe everything came from something impersonal, you have a couple of problems to begin with. One of them is, how did it all get form and shape? If there's nothing personal behind the universe, why don't we have just a bunch of pebbles? Why is there organization, design? And the second is, where did personality come from? If everything came from something impersonal, where did personality come from? The biblical answer is that before Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God was. That's where everything came from, something personal. The message of Genesis, creation, fall. Man set himself against God and brought consequences of tragedy on the whole human race, individually and on society. Civilization, men began to try to live together. There were times of pride and struggle, such as Babel. There were times of greater agreement and unanimity, also described in Genesis. But the beginnings of civilization are there. Judgment, the flood, the Tower of Babel, and finally redemption. God created. Man rebelled. Man tried to live together and carry on his rebellion in togetherness. Judgment came, but God didn't want his final word to be judgment. That would have meant failure of all. Instead, God wanted redemption. And so the book of Genesis sets out to tell us how God chose one man. He didn't tell us why. The descendants of that one man often look very much like other men, but God knew Abraham, and he chose him. And through him, he would bring one into the world through whom all nations of earth would be blessed. That's Genesis. It's there not to answer every question our curiosity can raise, but to give us in very brief sweep the way things began, the need for redemption, and God's opening steps to bring it about. If we begin with that beginning, we're ready for God to develop men through law and through prophets until finally his Son comes, showing what the Father's really like. Redemption. We take it as commonplace because we've always known its possibility, its reality. But is it real in your life? Do you need to come while we sing?